Daniel Markham here with another week of Nerd Roundup. DanielBMarkham.com. If you haven't been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed a damn thing, to be honest with you. So I'm going to say the only serious thing I have to say in the next hour or so. The reason I do Nerd Roundup is programming should be a joy. It should be fun. It should be something you like doing. And as part of that, you should be able to kick back and talk with your friends over lunch and go out to eat. You should be enjoying yourself, and it shouldn't be a stressful environment. You know, the business and marketing folks, goodness gracious, they make things hard enough for us. We should have fun on our own. So here we are, end of the week, Friday afternoon, and I'm with Bob Martin. Mr. Bob.
Hi.
How's your week been going so far?
Oh, gosh. Good week. Let's see. Tuesday managed to take a patient to someplace in the middle of Michigan doing a Lifeline pilot flight. So those are always fun.
You got that little Cirrus you're flying, right? The parachute?
Yeah, it's an SR-22. It's a nice little plane. And I can put people in there and then haul them around, you know, a couple of hundred miles. So that's fun to do. And let's see, did some shooting, filming.
Yeah, life flight shooting could not, they might not work together, Joey. Yeah.
Did some filming with my daughter on episode 66 of Clean Code. So that'll be good. That's Architecture, the Art of Drawing Lines. That'll be the episode there.
Have you done boxes already? Or is that like a separate?
No, boxes are coming later. We have to focus several episodes on lines.
Yes. The thing is, I understand what you're saying. It sounds completely ridiculous, but you could do a whole episode easily on joins and lines and cardinality and OCL and a lot of stuff there.
Ah.
So, Bob, is UML dead? I saw this article this week. I don't know if you saw it or not, that said, you know, why UML died. Another one was, you know, I think I killed UML. I was in the kitchen with a notepad or something. It was a whole line of things around UML. Have you seen any of these articles this week?
Oh, I see articles about UML being dead all the time and test-driven development being dead all the time. Yeah, I ignore articles like that. I haven't seen them recently, but okay, it doesn't surprise me that there are some out there like that. I use UML all the time, you know. When I'm doing these videos, I scratch UML diagrams on the whiteboard, so it's very useful.
Yeah, there's a sort of an endless stream of, I tried this thing I don't understand, it didn't work for me, therefore the thing is bad. It just keeps going on and on.
Yeah, and there's also this thing that anything that is more than 5 years old is so hopelessly out of date that we don't need to pay any attention to it at all.
Yeah, wouldn't it be weird if other professions did that too? You know, hey, I could cut you with a scalpel, but you know, it's 100-year-old technology.
Yeah.
I'm going to use this rusty spoon today, okay? Is that okay? Yeah. Like, no. Yeah, it's UML is just a sketching. It's a way to sketch. Why would you not want to have ways to sketch?
Oh, yeah, I think they kind of overdid it when they originally defined UML. You know, they had the meta model and everything like that. But in the end, you know, arrows and boxes and pretty straightforward as long as you don't go get carried away with it.
Yeah, I think the key thing about UML is any sort of modeling exists to make decisions and have conversations. And if you make it a thing of its own, it becomes this sort of monster train set that takes over the universe. And
yeah, they certainly tried.
Yeah, I've got this book. When UML first came out, it was called UML Distilled.
Oh, yeah.
It was about 40 pages.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing the nerd thing to me again.
Yeah.
I have it right here.
This is Martin Fowler's book. Very famous, right?
Yes. Yes.
I could get my camera to focus.
Bob, where are you at, Bob?
Let's see. I think I'm going to turn off that blurring thing that I've got going
on. Yeah,
it didn't help at all.
Let's focus. It's not the blur. It's actually the depth of field, dude. Yeah, you got to get right in that spot.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, yeah. So, yeah, UML Distilled, Martin Fowler. Lovely little book.
Yes.
Yeah, like you said, 40 pages. And even this is probably way too much.
Yeah, if I remember, either that book or another book, the gist of it at the end, it was like, you know, hey, we just kind of played around with this so it would solve problems for us. And I read that, I'm like, yes, I get this. I understand this. This works for me. So next up, we've got to talk about the circle of life, which, as I understand it right now, is Verilog Minecraft Factorio. There's this sort of universe going on. So if you guys don't know it, Verilog is a way to sketch out and model hardware systems. And somebody had this cool idea. We'll take Verilog and make it into a Factorio compiler. So that you can take your hardware sketch and make little Factorio games out of this. Wow. What a complete waste of time. This would be fun. And then I looked up, but wait, there's more. There's a Minecraft Verilog compiler. Like, holy shit.
So this is entirely worthwhile.
Yeah. Hey, you should have been warmed up front, folks. There's nothing. So you could take, as I understand it now, you could take your Verilog, turn it into Minecraft, and then into Factorio. Oh. And then we talked last week about they're doing this ray tracing thing with your Minecraft world. So you're working in your office, somebody comes in and says, what are you doing? And it's just zooming over this mountain scene. Oh, yeah, I'm actually coding some hardware up right now.
Have you ever played Factorio?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, because that's a really addictive game. I spent far too many hours making my factory, trying to launch my rocket. But I mean, it's a fun game. It's a lot of interesting logic and logistics. And you've got to start small and then tear down and build up bigger and then tear down and build up bigger. It's just really, really fun game. And then, you know, these guys make these compilers that'll simulate a circuit. So I think in there, one of them took a 6502 Verilog script.
Yeah, made it into a Minecraft game. Where's that at? Yeah, that's why not?
So then all he has to do is load the Commodore 64 ROM into it, and he's got a C64 in
there. Yes,
there's the Factorio.
Like, oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Have you seen some of those? I mean, there's a guy who did a full 6502 in Minecraft. Complete with a screen.
Oh, God.
And ASCII digits on the screen. That the screen is enormous because every pixel is a meter square in Minecraft.
Right.
But, you know, he managed to wire the whole doggone thing up and execute Mario Kart with it or something.
You should have played Minecraft.
It runs really slow. Really, really slow. Yeah.
So I did the Factorio thing. I dived deep on that thing. I probably spent 300-400 hours on it. But then Minecraft, I stayed away.
Good.
It seemed like Minecraft, it was like fun. Somebody did like flashing lights or a logic circuit and then just went completely. People started doing CPUs and it got crazy.
Oh, yeah, Minecraft goes completely nuts. Factorio, at least you can kind of keep some bounds around it. Minecraft just goes crazy. I have spent so many hundreds of hours on Minecraft, just building useless things. But, you know?
It's very delicate, yes. Yeah, I had fun. That's fun stuff. I was talking about Factorio this morning on Hacker News. Somebody wrote an article that Factorio is actually a good game to learn better programming habits. It takes away a lot of your skills while you're doing it, but it does teach you that you can build something that works fine for now that you're going to have to change later on and expect some sort of change in your code, which I thought was a good lesson.
That's really necessary in Factorio. There's no way to incrementally get from the very beginning to the very end. You have to go through these massive redesigns. And of course, redesigns are always dangerous. So you have to learn the refactoring skills of Factorio, the refactorio skills. But you have to learn those things in order to gradually grow this thing and rip out parts and replace parts while you're keeping the rest of it running. It's very, very difficult. But once you learn the skill, it's very rewarding.
Yeah, no, the first thing I wanted was a robot army because who the hell doesn't want a robot army? I mean, you got to have a robot army. But But I liked the train. I found the train was this whole thing with the logic gates and the train schedule, and that was just that really, yeah, that. Yeah, that was bad.
I thought I was done when I had the train thing going around and going to the different mines and different. I thought I was done. I thought this is just so cool. I'm not going to touch it anymore. I'm just going to watch that train set run. But then I needed to build the rocket. You know,
yeah,
you got to build the rocket.
But see, you can put multiple trains and you have signals and you do logic circuits on each. Yeah, it's
so
bad.
Cool.
Yeah,
so cool.
So the next article is about F#.net and machine learning. And it's just somebody asked a question about machine learning and .NET, and there's actually a couple libraries people are interested. There's TensorFlow, and there's DiffSharp. I haven't played with any of these. Have you done any ML, Bob, lately?
No, I've done a little ML. I haven't done any TensorFlow or DiffSharp. TensorFlow, as I recall, TensorFlow is an older AI library, which I have not played with. I just kind of read a little bit about it. And DiffSharp I'd never heard of.
Yeah, I definitely, this kind of has been calling to me for several years now, the whole ML sort of, yeah, it's good, cool stuff. There was another article here, I think the guys called Cerebus have come out with it. They're doing AI dedicated chips now. This is a 1.3 trillion transistor AI chip. And it's got like 200-300 gigabytes of RAM co-located with the transistors on. It's like this, you can see the size. It's the size of a dinner plate.
Oh, that's the chip.
That's the chip. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. That's like, wow.
Well, what are those dots on it?
They're very little posts. That's where you build your tents. I don't know how you plug this up. Can you imagine the number of pins it has on the flip side? It's
okay. Well, yeah, I don't quite get that, but you know, a trillion transistors, you can fit a trillion transistors in a smaller die than that.
But it's got hundreds of gigs of RAM co-located with the transistors.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, maybe that's it.
Well, I didn't get too far into it, but the CEO was talking about auto-pathing. And what it sounded like, if you've ever read about FPGAs, fixed programmable gate arrays, is that this is a self-programmable chip in the sense that it can rewire itself. So
is the idea that it's a programmable neural net?
Yes.
So you can load in the coefficients and the number of stages and the number of the width of the stages and stuff?
Yes, exactly. And then cool. it does it all on one thing. Part of the problem they ran into, first off, was having to go off board to get the RAM, go to the memory array or whatever. And so they just stuck everything you might possibly need into one chip, and here it is.
Okay, well, that's cool. See, be interesting to see what happens with that. There's an immense amount of hype around, you know, neural nets and AI, and of course, they're going to take over the world, and we're going to build Skynet one day. That I don't think we're going to come close to anytime soon.
No, I'm ready for the robot army, dude. I have mastered the robot army. What a comment. I'm putting it to work on a train right away. I've got plans for
it. Jump into the factorial world. Yeah, so Boston Dynamics guys, you know, robot army. I look at those, like the little dog Spot. That's cool. I like that thing. It can walk around factories and look at little gears and meters and things and turn valves. But, you know, you think, you know, what else could they do with those dogs? And there's your robot army.
Yeah. What is the old thing? And this has been true as long as I've been coding. It's like, I just want somebody to get me a beer. I don't care what it is. Just want beer. You know, go get the beer. I can't keep the kids doing that. Can you give me a robot that would do that?
I think Spot could do that. You put that arm on it.
Yeah,
and it can open up the fridge and get you a beer. Smart enough to do that. Be fun to write that code.
I think it'd be better to have the beer, but I'll watch somebody else write the code. Yeah,
but we're programmers. We write the code to get the beer. Well, and yeah, they don't have to write that code anymore.
They've abstracted this somehow or another. So the Boston Dynamics guy was talking a week or two ago that they don't actually go movement by movement. They worked out some sort of abstraction layer, like just go to the other room. So that's pretty cool.
That is cool. They do a little pathfinding and image, you know, object avoidance, and that's pretty cool stuff.
It turns out that sort of AI and ethics and sort of this intelligent ethics programming seem to be the sort of the thing this week for some reason. I'm not really sure why, but this is sort of an exception. This is about content marketing, and there's this whole discussion about, do people actually pay for content, or do they pay because they want a relationship with the person making the content, or is it the platform they're actually paying for? And I just thought this was interesting because it beats the hell out of me. I don't understand the profit model there at all. You have any thoughts on, is the channel more important? The people, the number, the network effect? What makes one system of consuming things better than another? Like, where do you go to get podcasts? Do you go to Apple?
I go to Apple to get my podcasts right now. And some of them I pay for and some of them are free. The ones I pay for, you know, I'm interested in the content because those guys they say good things, or I like what they say, or I'm interested in what they say. So I'm willing to pay a small monthly fee for that. I have a couple of YouTube channels that I contribute with Patreon. I'm a little bit reluctant to use Patreon, but all right, I use Patreon to try and support those channels. And then for some, that's where, you know, you're really paying for content, right? You just have decided that the content is useful and you're going to pay for it. Then there's a whole bunch of YouTube channels that I follow and I tolerate the ads.
Yeah.
That's another kind of paying for content. Wouldn't it be interesting, though, to have a network where you pay by the packet or something, and it's those fees that go to all your content providers?
That's cool. Have you tried the Clubhouse, either using or being on the other side of that?
I haven't. Don't you have to get invited to that?
Yeah, it's a secret. Don't tell me. Yeah, it's very secret. They only have like a million people so far.
Okay.
So it's very exclusive. Yeah, I'm interested. I've got actually two people asked me if I was interested. I've got two invites. Michael Feathers is doing some kind of a testing thing there.
Really?
I haven't had time to go. I don't.
Okay.
Too much stuff.
Yeah, too much stuff. Too much stuff. I don't know why I do this with you.
Well, it's obviously the millions of dollars we receive in recurring income.
Yeah, that's very.
I was a member of Locals. I was on Locals for about 6 months trying to ramp this up, and you can subscribe there like Patreon. And so once I switched over to my own stuff, I actually made a message, guys, I'm out of here. But I still have a subscriber there, and God bless you, thank you. I just got an email this morning. It's like, you have $1.44 deposited directly to your account. I'm like, woohoo! Yes! we're going to town this week. I'm sorry. $1.44. Thank you. Thank you. I actually, it kind of made my day, really. So this is just another one of these, what kind of drives the internet aside from cat pictures? I don't know. pizzas. How about this McDonald's ice cream machine story? Now this is wild. this is really crazy. Did you see this?
No, I didn't see this. All I saw was headlines yesterday about that tried to tell me why McDonald's ice cream machines are always broken, and I didn't bother to read those. So I'm surprised to see it show up here.
So as it turns out, McDonald's. We nerds are not the only people that tend to overcomplicate things like UML. McDonald's has done this with their shake machines. You can spend between $10,000 and $20,000 now for an intelligent milkshake machine that overnights boils the liquids and cleans itself, except for once a week when you still have to take it apart, but you don't have to take it apart every night. So
because that's the way it used to be, right? The Dairy Queen guys used to have to tear down those machines and sanitize them every night because they got milk in them.
Yes.
They're going to grow horrible nasties in there if you don't clean them out.
So I guess if this were the only story, it wouldn't be a story at all for nerds. But what happened was that the people who made this thing put a warning on it. Put a CPU on it. Put a menu screen, and they didn't give the users and the operators all the access they needed to see how the machine worked. So you would come in the next day, and maybe the machine cycled overnight, and you had milkshakes. Maybe it didn't. you couldn't tell what was happening. You had to hire a special service tech for hundreds of dollars an hour, hundreds of dollars an hour, to come to your McDonald's and access the secret menu. So he could tell you, this, somebody said it was like an Italian sports car. It was really, it was cool as hell when it ran, but it broke every other week and you had to pay thousands of dollars to have it fixed. So another bunch of really smart nerds said, you know what we need is a little piggyback box that monitors the signaling inside the milkshake machine and tells the operator, hey, you know, just add some oil here or whatever, and then they don't have to pay the hundreds of dollars. And, of course, people were buying things like hotcakes, and McDonald's sues their own distributors and say, no, no, hell no, you can't be mucking around with the machines. They're like, no, we're not mucking around. We bought this thing to add on. No, you can't add things onto the machines. This is our proprietary stuff we have here. And so it's this whole milkshake war going on with McDonald's and these guys. It's like, wow.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know what happened here, right? It was initially they were planning to have an administrator interface that the operators could use, but it was too difficult and they had to get it out early. So instead of a nicely designed administrator interface, the programmers cobbled together some horrible thing that the programmers could use, you know, where you're actually entering byte codes or something horrible like that. And then that turned into a business model.
It's a C++ guy you can never get rid of. Like, oh, yes, I'm the milkshake technician, buddy.
Why should we add that console now when they're paying us to go in and type in hexadecimal? We'll just keep on going in there and typing in hexadecimal, and we'll get lots of money. And then, of course, some other programmer comes along and says, well, I know how to turn the hexadecimal into a nice little user screen. And so now they're suing him over that.
Oh, yeah. You can't peer inside the cryptologically secure milkshake machine at McDonald's just anytime you want to, Bob. Some national security stuff going on in there. We just can't let anybody in there.
You can't plug into our interface. No, no.
You know, John Deere did this same thing. They started, they've been selling tractors. They're one of the oldest companies in America. And they started selling tractors that farmers could not repair their own tractors anymore.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yep. Interesting business model, right? It's hard nowadays to get into a car and try and, you know, clean the points in the magneto.
So I was watching this movie that was set in the future last week, and this guy had a job, and his job basically was to identify curtains. I was like, what? So he sat in front of a screen, and he watched this video people would capture all over the world, you know, people having sex, people eating, a whole bunch of stuff, and he would just identify the type of curtains that was in the room because the AI couldn't figure it out. So what do we actually do?
They were hacking into people's televisions.
No, the people agreed to this. It's just they wanted the AI to determine what all the things in the house and the scene was so they could buy new curtains or what. So his job was just to sort out types of curtains all day long.
I see. Okay. This is kind of a crowdsourcing thing, isn't it? Look at these pictures. What kind of curtains are these?
Like an ink blot. Does this look like a squirrel? It's like, no. The Rorsch, they call it the Rorschach test or something, isn't it?
Did you ever participate in any of the crowd science stuff, like identifying craters on the moon or identifying the shapes of galaxies or stuff like
that? The SETI at Home was one of those things, I believe, as well.
SETI at Home was where they took over your computer and while your computer was idling, and they would ship data to your computer and it would analyze it and send it back. So that was one of the first big massively parallel network-driven algorithms. But these crowdsource things, or these crowd science things, they're actually sending pictures to people. And then the people will look at them and say, yeah, that looks like a crater. That one doesn't look like a crater. That one's got rays. That one doesn't got rays. And they fill in a bunch of little checkboxes for each picture. Or galaxies, pictures of galaxies. You know, this one looks like a spiral galaxy. This one looks like an elliptical galaxy. Oh, wow. This one's got a little funny thing on it. Because there's so much data pouring in from all the observation devices we have now. There's no way to analyze it without getting 100,000 people looking at it and trying to identify interesting things. And human brains are the only things that can do it.
Well, you know, the reason why is that brains cheat. We just your brain will come for an answer in a category whether or not you have any data to go on or not. It's very happy making stuff up.
Yeah, so this is a neural network that has been tuned over several billion years. I think the coefficients in here probably work out pretty well. Boy, my whole phone is going nuts. Yeah. Huh. Well, I don't know what that is. I don't care. Okay.
This is the AI thing is interesting because they're using the people. The crowdsourcing is to create the learning set to use it.
Cool.
So we talked last week about this generative adversarial networks where we have the two AIs kind of bouncing off one another.
Oh yeah, that's right.
This next article uses the adversarial part of that to actually muck up the recognition part. So everybody's concentrating, let's have these things fight so it can recognize a creator, a face or whatever. But the discriminator thing actually has its own. You can turn it around backwards and say, okay, make me a picture that you can't recognize the guy's face with. It turns out you can like add like a little black dot up here or just these little tiny things. Totally screws up the AI. We're all going to have like our own little AI on our phones to mix up our pictures. It's like, holy shit.
This is good. Yeah. So as you're going down the tollway and they try to take a picture of your license plate, right? If you've already done the obscuration, you've run it through the algorithm, you just put a little piece of black tape in just the right place. They can't read your license plate.
Yes. Or you could put an LCD screen on top of your plate, clear, and then it would just put up a random pixel as you go under the camera and they would screw it up every time. But a cop behind you would be fine. Nobody else could ever see that it was screwed up.
I know what I'd put on that screen. I'm not going to say that.
So last year for my birthday, I bought this little box. It's an LED box you stick in the back of your car. It's like those marquee things you see at the donut store. So all those times you had something you wanted to say to the guy behind you, some of which you may not want to repeat in mixed company, you can make the little lights. They're like, hey, bub, back off.
I have wanted that for so many years. Just with a few buttons on the front panel, I could just push on the dead. I got something to say to you, buddy.
My kids told me this probably would not be a healthy thing to do for longer time.
But we don't need that now because we have the internet. So we can do it all day long to everyone.
Yeah, everybody's their own target now. I was really looking at Far Side this morning, and it was like the people needed somebody to be mad at, and it was Wayne. And they had all these people with signs, down with Wayne, death to Wayne. It's like, what? It's your day, Bob. Thanks.
Yeah, Far Side.
He's come back, hasn't he? Gary Larson's...
Yeah, I just saw a couple of things by him recently.
Yeah, cool stuff. He's doing that new kind of tech with the color stuff.
Yes. His
next, yeah.
So the cows are brown now.
No, it's like I'm not going to say spherical cows because there's a whole thing there, but he's doing some kind of 3D thing that's different than he did before. It's interesting. I just don't say about this. They've broken into the DC police station. They've taken all their data hostage. And now they're actually like extorting the police department to pay up or they'll release all the informants all over the internet.
Okay, that's bad. That's really bad. Yeah,
I would think most people would agree this would be a bad thing.
This is bad. Yeah, well, they must feel like they're safe, these hackers. I wonder how right they are about that. You know, are they the smartest people in the world or is there a smarter guy who's going to figure out how to follow those threads back and take care of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On one side, we have this. Is this going to end up being kinetic? And on the other side, it's like, should we be putting this stuff all in one network database to begin with? Because isn't that creating a central point of failure?
These ransomware guys are just terrible people. Just awful.
They're bad, but the weird thing is, like, you know, at what point does this stop? And I don't know if it ever stops. It just, it'll just keep growing because I don't think there's anything. This is the radar versus radar detector we just did with the facial recognition. Only we're talking about something much, much more serious, which is stealing informants' names.
That's the D.C. police too, huh? Washington D.C.
Yeah, I mean, they had no shame. Yeah,
they might have just decided to attack the wrong target there. It's just possible.
I have some friends in crypto, and they tell me that they've been holding up city governments for some time now, that most people who get held up like this don't publish it because they don't want people to know.
Sure. You know, and that gets into a really interesting topic, this whole issue of hacking into computers. That's the result of programmers being wildly irresponsible for decades.
Yes.
And having, no idea of the impact of one lazy hour of coding. Imagine just how terrible it is that SQL is text-based and that you can send SQL through the network and actually control somebody else's database. That never needed to happen. None of that ever needed to happen. We did not need to make SQL a text-based language. It could have always been a nice little API, which was completely unhackable.
There's an XKCD cartoon that punchline is, "Oh yeah, that's my son. He's little Bobby Null Tables." The idea being,
little Bobby Tables. Time. Yep.
You couldn't sense. Yeah, I'm a mixed mind here. I'm afraid, and by afraid, I'm concerned that perhaps this is such a house of cards we built with technology that it may be better just to keep all of this stuff written down in a ledger somewhere. We had things that worked. They're called pencils and paper. They seemed to work very fine for hundreds of years.
Yeah, what's really important is backups. Just keep backups, damn it.
Oh, yeah.
Back it all up. If the ransomware people come, well, now these guys have got a problem because the ransomware people are threatening to release the informants. So that's really bad. Most of the ransomware stuff is where they just lock your machine and they won't unlock it. Right. And, okay, I got a backup. Screw you.
You guys win. Okay, get the backup out. Yeah.
Have you been attacked by people who have discovered one of your less secure passwords?
And then
threaten to put pictures of you on the internet.
No, it's
we took pictures through your camera because this is your password. That's a password. They sent me an email about this.
Oh, really? Oh my God.
15 years ago. Oh, yeah, that's a really sensitive password you found right there.
So I was talking, speaking to Michael Feathers in this topic, I was talking to him about a year ago. We're talking about this deep fake thing where they can take your face and put it on porn and then threaten to release the porn. And
yeah.
I'm like, Michael, dude, this is like my teenage dream finally coming true. I'm like in every porn movie I ever wanted to be in.
Please.
Can I send you I've got a list. Can I send you a list of what I like?
Yeah, it doesn't matter anymore, right? No, but you can put any picture you want on the internet and no one, everyone will go, somebody concocted that out of something. It's not real.
You reached the opposite place where you want to be. Now you can publish any damn thing. Nobody ever believes you.
Yeah, come on, that's a fake.
Yeah, I had a Russian hacker break into my email server once, and every year for Christmas he would send me a Merry Christmas email from the hacker inside my ear. I'd be like, "Hey, good Merry Christmas!" I'm like, "Oh, thanks, hacker, I appreciate it." He never got enough trouble that blocked my mail going in or out, and I didn't really care whether he was in there or not. So we had kind of a symbiotic thing going on for a while.
Okay. My little friend has come in again.
Yeah, it's like having a stray cat. Like, come here, Hulof, come here. So this is a tech article about constraint-based programming. And it's quite lengthy, and I thought it was a bit muddled. And I read this again this morning. I think it boils down to don't do bad stuff. It's like 1,000 words. Of course, the question is, how do you enforce constraints in a consistent way? I believe there's some things involving testing that probably would help there. This is not a good.
Yeah, article. I didn't read the article, so I'm not really up on that. But one of the things that's common in our industry is people want to get ahead of the publishing curve, so they will write a book with virtually zero content, but lots of buzzwords and phrases. And then they'll get it out really early and they'll give it the right title and people will buy tens of thousands of copies of it and then realize that they've got, you know, 100,000 words or 1 million words that add up to about one sentence.
Ooh. Ooh, yeah.
We saw a lot of that with service-oriented architecture about 20 years ago.
I had a lobster, some guy was, we were talking about some programming topic. Oh, yeah, do you review code bases to determine whether they're good or not? And I was like, I don't want to just, I mean, I understand learning programming. I do that all the time. I'm interested in programming patterns, but I can't review somebody's code unless I understand what they're trying to do with the code. So, I mean, we could academically talk about a good Q class or how a stack should work. And that's foundational stuff everybody should know walking out of school. Sure. Yeah. But when I'm looking at somebody's like object library, I'm like, well, what the hell? What's this supposed to do? I mean, it may be bug proof and not do anything valuable. So, yeah, I have there's no criteria for me to do that. But anyway, my point being is I'm responding back and I wrote this like 500 word like comment. And I went around the barn and the bush and whatever on top. And I got to the end, I published and I went back and looked at it. I'm like, you know, I could have probably replaced that with two sentences. And I thought, nah. make them suffer.
Who was it that said, I'm sorry this letter's so long, I didn't have time to make it shorter?
Mark Twain, I think. I'm not sure.
Was it Mark Twain? Maybe it was Voltaire. I don't know. Somebody like that.
Voltaire and Mark Twain. Yeah, they're very similar. French existentialist atheist guy with a beard that looks like Colonel Sanders. Yeah, it's close. This is like anybody can tell me what's here that I need to know, that would be great. Because I'm curious because it's like a lot of people seem to like this. What the hell's going on? Next up is this cheerleader who I think she was kicked off the team or something, and she got on Snapchat and just basically went into a profanity-laden tirade at her school, as teenagers are wont to do, and so they expelled her. They punished her very harshly, and Snapchat is just among friends, and it's a time-based thing, so she took measures to make sure it was, but of course kids, oh wow, just wait till the teacher reads this, so I'm like, wow, that's... The experts say there's no way for the Supreme Court to judge here that's not going to be a big ball of crap.
I'm surprised the Supreme Court's going to take this up. That's interesting. What do the justices see in this that could be significant enough for a Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, see, the thing is that schools, by virtue of managing minors, have to have codes of conduct that apply to people and teachers as well, both on and out of school. You can't have a teacher dating a student, even if it's off campus. So what kind of reach do they have on these rules they have? And if they do have reach into the kid's home, what are the rules that they have to follow in creating these and enforcing these rules?
That's interesting. Yeah. Can a school go into your social network that's not associated with school and then punish you for what you say on that social network? Interesting. Okay, so it'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does. A lot of interesting Supreme Court cases coming up this year.
yeah, a bunch of a couple Second Amendment ones. And, the thing here, I think it gets back to the fact that we're treating computers as if they're kind of record players, to play content for one another. And they're really more like extensions of our brain. So these kids use the computer not to store and produce videos, but to think aloud with other kids, just to talk.
Yeah.
And so it's a new kind of tool, really.
So, if you've got a bunch of kids and they're standing around in a circle and they start saying bad things about a teacher, but they're off school grounds, they're off at some coffee shop or something, and then somebody else overhears that, and maybe
nothing happens. He said, she said, okay, you probably said the wrong thing. You're fine. Had that same thing with somebody with a cell phone, and suddenly you've got a problem.
It's interesting. It's interesting. The whole society is going to have a big eventual resolution with this social network stuff because it's crazy.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, we like I said, until we understand the actual tools, and I think we nerds kind of understand better than most folks, we're never going to get the law right either. It's just not going to work.
Is this a digital needle or is that Saturn's rings?
This is actually a photograph that they've scanned in a record. And it also looks like Saturn's rings as well.
It does, yeah. Uh-huh.
And they, by scanning in the record, they're able to reproduce the music on the record. Isn't that cool?
Okay, is this stereo? No,
you can't, of course, you're probably thinking, but couldn't we just put it on a turntable? But no.
Oh, no. We need to digitize.
We could use satellite imagery with x-rays.
Okay, so now maybe you know more about this than I do. As I recall, vinyl records that were stereo would wiggle the needle back and forth for one channel and up and down for the other channel.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That is correct.
I think that's right.
Yep.
So are they seeing both? I can see how they could get the left and right. Yeah, how would they get the up and down?
I stopped halfway through because it was so cool. I was like, hey, I'll probably read this.
Like, it's so cool. I need to stop reading it now.
Well, this is the third article. I've read one about how 78 records actually have no correct way to play back because the speed was inconsistent. I read another article on this a couple years back with the same thing, and I thought, you know, if my brain didn't absorb this crap the first two times, I'm not going to push it in again. It's just going to fall out the other side.
Yeah, especially with 78s because the radial velocity stays the same, but the linear velocity gets slower and slower as you get towards the middle of the record, right? So the frequencies get closer and closer. The wavefronts get closer and closer. And then with a 33, that's not so bad because they kept all of those traces towards the outside. Not 33, what am I saying? 45. And then with the 33 and the third, remember these, the old LPs?
Yes.
Right? And that was pretty wide. There was a lot of surface there. So it was probably a fairly large factor of compression of the wavefronts as you got close to the center. This would be a really interesting program to write to figure this out.
Did you know they actually did this with videos? There is a indentation-based version of a video disc. Not a laser disc, but a vinyl disc that plays movies.
Yeah, I remember those.
Ooh, cool. They're
very brief. I remember there was a very brief period of time when you could get a turntable to play a video.
Wow.
But then you know, they went to the videotape thing. Videotape had that nice little spinning head that would write the helical data along the tape. And then, of course, it went to CDs.
Oh, I had a full size laser disc back in the day with the you put the huge disc in, it played movies for you. Really cool.
Was it not the same form factor? Was it a larger form factor?
It was LP or bigger, I believe.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, it was big size.
Still a laser disc, but it was, you know, 14-inch or 12.
It was big and it did not use the bumps. It was a laser disc, but it was a huge format size, wonderful quality, best quality of anything. Really.
I don't remember that at all. That's interesting. Of course, that technology just went so fast. We went from CDs to DVDs, and now we don't give a damn. We don't know where it's kept. Somewhere on the cloud. Whatever a cloud is.
Oh. I used to go buy DVDs, and there was only one store in town that had them. And there would only be like maybe five or six titles back in the back aisle. There would be like this little special corner they had for us nerds. And you're like, oh, they just got, you know, Conan the Barbarian's out. Woo-hoo! And it'd be a happy day when that one movie came in. Yeah, that's sad. That's really sad. And now I have 50,000 channels of shit I can't watch and don't want to watch. It's like, holy cow.
That's a song from The Wall.
Yes, it is.
That's a phrase from The Wall. Very good.
Yep, on the TV
16,000.
Yes.
It was just
Side B, I think. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful albums. So this is a completely insane story. If you're going through the Linux messaging, which I wasn't, but somebody was, there's a comment that said they introduced kernel bugs on purpose, and that had to have gotten anybody's eye that looked at this. Yes, it took a look at four accepted patches, and three of them had security holes. So the Linux guys were like, they're actually making bugs in our open source on purpose. And this, to me, is like the number one story of the week. God bless them, as my grandmother might say. The people from the University of Minnesota, their computer department, or maybe it's Michigan. Minnesota, decided that they would, on purpose, introduce bugs into the code base for the Linux kernel. As a way of testing stuff, and that's not going to get anybody pissed off, of course.
So I've seen things like this, and maybe this is what's going on, where a publisher, for example, will introduce a spelling error into a book or a misformed letter, and that's how they would detect copyright infringement.
Well, yeah, that's the cool way of doing this. And there's also the red blue team stuff where you agree with the people ahead of time you're going to try to attack a system. These guys, without telling anybody, decided to introduce their own bugs into their production code base eventually, just to see what they could get away with.
Oh, this.
Yeah. It turns out you get away with a lot before they catch you. And it also turns out that they're going to kill you. I mean, not literally kill you, but they get pretty mad when they
So,
find out.
do you remember the strategy a while back of the bug monkey? Right. So, how did this work? You'd have a large system, a big web-based system. And what you'd do, you wanted to detect whether or not your failovers worked correctly. So,
Oh, yes. The Simian Army, Netflix.
Okay, right. The chaos monkeys,
Yes, yes.
Right. And so these soft, our video has frozen. The software would go in and purposely introduce failures
Yes.
to make sure that the failure recovery systems work
Yes.
properly.
And that actually made sense to me at an infrastructure level because
Sure.
with the stack being so huge of tech, you just have to assume it's going to fail instead of trying to. You can't introduce regressive testing all the way down the stack. So you can just say, okay, for whatever reason this failed, does the whole system still work or not?
Yeah,
But yeah,
that
this is a.
makes sense. That's not what these guys were doing.
Yeah, this is more like the evil flying monkeys from the Wizard of Oz. This is not good. They're not the happy debugging monkeys. So they rolled back all their commits. There was a lot of angry stuff said. They got online and did a, oh, golly gee, we're sorry about all that, guys. Hopefully we didn't hurt anybody's feelings or anything. And yeah, wow, this is yeah, not happy. As you can see on Hacker News, there was 2,000 comments on this video. Boy, you want to
A
get
bit of a
people
race,
beating. Oh yeah, get people commies. Yeah, the professor gets exactly what they want here. No, yeah, they get a paper to write. And yeah, that's just back.
and Linus is out of it now, isn't he?
It's I don't I've never met Linus and met Stallman. I don't know. It's this whole inside baseball thing: who's in, who's out, who's the popular person? What did they say? How did they do it?
I think Linus is out. I've never met Linus. I have met Richard Stallman. I had a very fascinating lunch with Richard Stallman about a year ago.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, just before COVID, right? I was in Boston for something or other, and somebody arranged a lunch, and all of a sudden I'm sitting across from Stallman. Okay.
And the two things I know about, maybe three things, is that he's a little eccentric, I believe.
You might say. You might say.
He predicted a lot of things ahead of time, security, privacy,
Yeah.
and he can be a bit abrasive to folks, I guess. So did you notice these three characteristics as soon as you
I
got
was
here?
extremely polite the entire time. And yes, eccentric is probably the right word. And certainly he has opinions that he had to defend for so long and so vociferously that he assumes that every time he must defend them, he must defend them vociferously. So, it was a very cordial but very, very interesting lunch.
Cool. I love our business, and one of the reasons is you get to meet so many cool people with the various personalities. It's
Sure do.
well, and not only is it the nerds you get to meet, but then you get to go into people's businesses and learn how the profit model works and how they do AR here, and that to me is sort of endlessly fascinating. Of course, then again, I'm the type guy spend 400 hours on Factorio, so your mileage may vary.
Hi.
Yeah.
See, Richard
Alternate,
Stallman wouldn't play a Factorio because he doesn't own the source code.
yes,
Right.
yeah, he was the one that did this thing about how he doesn't have a computer. It's because you can't actually have a computer anymore without getting something proprietary.
Yes, right. And he won't. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I wonder how right he's going to end up being proven. That's weird. So alternate inflation charts, this made me laugh. So back in my day, when I was growing up in the 70s, we had this thing called the misery index.
I remember. The
misery index, well, yeah, inflation plus unemployment.
Jimmy Carter invented the misery index.
Yeah, not on purpose, but yeah, he was there, actually.
Oh, no, I think he's the guy who coined it.
Oh, wow.
I think coined it in a State of the Union address.
Was this before or after he was attacked by a rabbit in his robot? I'm sorry.
Well, it's sometime after he dumped the Pepsi into the nuclear reactor.
I don't remember that one. Oh, wow.
Yeah, the Pepsi syndrome. Yeah. That's a famous Saturday Night Live skit where Jimmy Carter, who was a nuclear engineer, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And he did the whole China syndrome thing. He said, oh, well, a Pepsi fell in there. It's the Pepsi syndrome. Well, the same thing happened with 7-Up. No, that's an Uncola.
If you guys want to watch a...
jokes.
Uncola. There's a cool biography, I think, on Netflix or Amazon Prime about Rick and... was it Rickover? The admiral that created the nuclear submarine fleet. It is...
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool, nerdy stuff. But anyway, so we used to have the misery index with inflation and unemployment, and we've been pumping tons of cash into the economy for the last 20 years. I mean, they just got the presses running full time. And it's metaphorical presses. I understand how the modern banking system works. But so people have been going, oh, golly, how come we don't have this tons of inflation while they watch their equities stocks go through the roof? But it turns out, hey, inflation is fine. And you've been reading that. So somebody said, wait a minute, let's go back to the earlier definition of inflation we used in the 70s and run those numbers through. And it's, yeah, more like about 10% per year. Yeah. And this is nerd candy for anybody who likes politics, economics, because you can go on for hours about cost of living, what an average shopping cart is, QE, QE2, fractional banking, the gold reserve. It's like a cornucopia of nerdy topics in this thing.
Understanding the economy is really interesting. It's all these very interesting data flows with feedbacks and buffers and time delays. And then there's, of course, all the emotional content. There was a did you ever read the book Limits to Growth? It was one of those books in the 70s that was predicting the end of the world by the late 90s, right? And they went through that. They adopted this formalism to show these data flows and buffers and time delays. And they would put this whole thing together and put it in the computer and simulate it. And then all these graphs would come out and the graphs would show that the entire world is going to end by 1998.
Because it's a graph.
Yeah. I mean, follow.
And we have footnotes. Yeah.
Well, so it turns out that there was a program that you could get a little later that would take that formalism and allow you to redraw any kind of data flow with buffer and time-like thing. This was called Stella, Stella. And you on your laptop, you could then draw these interesting little data flow diagrams and put buffers in and valves and time lags and special functions. And you could show that the world was going to end according to your theory instead of someone else's theory, or model just about anything else. And one of the interesting models is a model of the economy or the stock market. So none of it ever comes to fruition, right? Because nobody's model is ever adequate enough. But it's fascinating that all this formalism was invented for these purposes.
I think. I've always said economics is sort of astrology for people who know calculus. It's like there's a lot of math and there's a lot of Greek letters and there's really some serious talk going on. I think if you could actually understand the economy, you would be a billionaire. And so the economy actively resists anybody understanding it. It's, you're never going to figure it out.
Well, so I've done a lot of consulting at nuclear accelerators. I did a lot of consulting at Slack and Brookhaven and places like that, teaching the nuclear physicists C++ so that they could write the code that runs in the detectors. And they're all postdocs, right? All these guys, really smart PhD postdoc guys, just really know the math. And the career path for those guys is to leave physics and go into the stock market. Oh, damn. Because they're the only ones who know the math.
Yes. Well, not only that, but then they'll get humbled a bit by how the math doesn't actually work against reality.
We've seen a few of those.
I worked worked for a while for the Simon Foundation in New York City. David Simon, billionaire mathematician who made all his money and just decided to do philanthropic stuff. And I think the guys who have the doctorate level of education, economics, and math, who are able to make money, those are the really smart guys you want to hang out with.
I'm happy to hang out with them, but I don't understand the math.
Hey, yeah. Hey, dude, $1.44 this morning. I try to stay humble. It's the humbleness that's tough. So this next one is the red and blue functions are actually a good thing. And I read this, and I'm like, what the hell is a red or blue function? And then I spent an otherwise could have been useful hour digging through this. It turns out that, I think this is Go, somebody said, hey, we should color our functions. But why not? Of course. And this should be red and yellow, blue, whatever the fuck. And I'm like, well, okay, why don't you make them plaid? Or is there like going to be like a theme, you know? And then, but what they're really saying is that mutable functions that use async really tend to screw things up for us pretty badly.
Okay.
So let's make them a special color. And then whenever you use that function, you look at the color and know that it's an async function and all that's going on.
Okay. Perfectly reasonable. In Lisp, we put a bang at the end of such functions.
Yes. Yeah, we do that. F-sharp's got those awaits, too. I don't know. Colors seem kind of weird. I'm not opposed to knowing what it is. And the IDE language should tell you what's going on. But everybody has their own color scheme of IDE anyway. If you're actually going to change these colors around, I don't know. Just something about that didn't sound right to me.
I went to Las Vegas with Ron Jeffries in 2002, I think it was, something like that. And he and I were doing a tag team talk about extreme programming. And Pete Code was there. Remember Pete Code?
Oh, yeah. Code your
okay. All right. Yeah. So, well, he was the guy who came up with Together J and the, he hired the team of Russian programmers who then went on to create JetBrains and IntelliJ and stuff like
John,
that.
John, our friend, mutual friend John Kern was on that
John
team.
Kern, that's right. So here's Pete Code. He gets up on stage before Ron and I do. And he says his talk is going to be object-oriented design in color. Okay. So, and he's got some scheme for coloring the UML diagrams. So you've got business objects are one color and use case objects are another, something like that. It's a very, very nice talk. But he walks on stage and he knows this is being recorded. So he says to the audience, this is what might happen. I'm going to go back now and I'm going to re-enter and I'm going to start my talk. And it's just possible that I will mess something up, and if I do, I'm going to walk back off stage and then come back in and start it. And if I can get past the first 20 seconds, everything will be fine.
Wow.
And then he walked off stage.
He did this.
And he walked on, and he said, and I'm Pete Code, and I'm going to introduce object-oriented design in color. And then he went on, and apparently he did not have the stumble that he was afraid of. But I thought it was fascinating that he knew himself so well that he could say, look, if I can just get past that first 10 or 20 seconds, I can keep on with the flow. But if I screw it up in that first 10 or 20 seconds, I'm going to be a mess and I won't be able to continue. Right. So I thought that was fascinating. It has nothing to do with the article.
It's a good story. Yeah. Yeah, you have to. Yeah, I think what it has to do with the article is that you're using the IDE language to hack back at the programmer to tell him, hey, look, dude, pay attention here.
Yeah. Okay. You know, if you want to use color that way, it's fine with me. I color all my comments bright red so that I can get rid of them.
Yeah. I didn't want to go to comment thing. Okay. So if you're coding by yourself and there's nobody else involved in the team, the best place to keep your notes is next to where you're solving the problem. You want to keep it a separate place. And you can delete, I don't care if you delete it later or not, but you want to keep notes. Don't use another tool and all this other stuff. So as far as solo programmers working through systems, I believe the note comments should go in right next to what you're doing.
Now, I have no problem with that idea at all. If you're keeping notes that way, I might not want them checked in. Although if they're kept separate enough, if they're not obscuring the code, I don't have a problem with that. My problem with comments is that people stick them in and they just make a mess out of the code.
Or they comment the previous solution and they update the solution to something new. It's like you're reading the comment being purposely misled about what the actual. Yeah. Oh God, yeah. When I do my F# demo code, I usually each function has like 5 or 6 lines, so I can remember what the hell to say when I'm walking through the code. Because I get on video, I'm like, and it's just all gone. There's nothing there. So yeah, this question here basically was: is this a good idea, or is this just sort of a whole bunch of butthurt in the language coming out through? Let's color our functions now. I can understand wanting to be reminded of whether your functions are async or mutable. I like the exclamation point a little better than color shadow.
That's an old convention, right? The bang at the end of a function if it's mutable.
So these guys wanted to make a movie, and they spent like a year trying to find the perfect lead because he was complex. He was like a rebel and all. And they finally decided, you know who the perfect guy for this is? James Dean. So James Dean is going to star in a movie next year, I think. Even though he's been dead about 70 years now.
Yeah, okay.
And everybody, of course, is going apeshit one way or another. Well, how can you do that? You're bringing Princess Leia back. That's okay for Star Wars. But James Dean's just going too far.
You know, they did that with, it was the Gemini movie, wasn't it? With, I can't think of the actor now. But they took him as a younger man, and they somehow made him into his clone, a younger clone.
Oh, yeah, that was a Will Smith, yeah.
Will Smith. I don't think they used his son at all in that. I just think they used other images of him as a younger man, and it almost worked. It didn't quite, you know, you could kind of tell something was off. With Princess Leia, you could really tell something.
Yeah,
that didn't work.
If you're a Martin Scorsese fan, this is not just one of's anymore. Scorsese did this, The Irishman, where his main actors, who are all now like 150, actually he de-aged them to show them what they were like in the 50s and 60s, and you really couldn't tell unless you were paying attention. It was scary. It was pretty good.
Well, we were talking about deep fakes. It is getting pretty interesting. Will we have actors in the future?
That's it. And I think that's our final arc. But what I'm interested in, not only that, is what is the, if there are no limits, if these guys have hacked in like the DC police station and now you're deep faking everybody and the brother, then what would prevent somebody from creating a complete deep fake experience for the internet? You log in your computer and nothing you see is real, but it all appears to be real. Yeah. I'm telling you, there's a movie in here somewhere, Bob. There's a movie Will Smith did that.
The thing we haven't done yet, and it's very surprising, the thing we haven't done yet is reliable human voice. We seem to be able to do the reliable pictures, but not voice.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. The pictures, the eye will make a picture of just very little amount of detail. But the voice, there's just sound waves going inside your throat, and there's the soft tissue, hard tissue. It's not so simple.
So I told you last week that I was replaying the audiobook of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Hmm. And there's this lovely sequence in there where the computer, Mike, the computer, has been talking for virtually the entire time with a perfectly reasonable human voice. But then there comes a time when he has to create an image of the rebel leader, Adam Selene, which is him, but he has to create him as a human. And the human technician says, well, this is way outside of your ability, Mike. You'll never be able to manage the video. Just, it'll be too hard for you. And Mike says, no, I think I can do it, but it'll take everything I've got. And it turns out that that's exactly the opposite, right? We figured out the video stuff. It's the audio stuff that's hard. That's very interesting.
There have been several, like Plan 9 from Outer Space. Boris Karloff was the What? It's Bela Lugosi. Right? One of those guys was the bad guy. He dies halfway through the thing, and they just substitute him. It would have been better if the other guy had been the same height. But
or looked anything like him.
Or looked anything like him. There's
but it's
some
okay.
Nits there.
You know, we'll just put a mask over your face, yeah. And no one will know.
I've become shy.
Oh, yeah. God, that movie. Plan 9 from Outer Space. Those of you who are listening probably have never heard of this movie. Go rent this movie. It is the worst movie ever made.
It is famously bad.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
If you want to have some friends over for beers this weekend, this is the movie to show, okay? You won't be sorry.
It's better than Rocky Horror. It is.
Oh, yeah. I love Rocky Horror. But, yeah, this is... And you look at this movie, you're like, who in their right mind would either pay for this or actually create this stuff? He had to make movies. Ed Wood just had to make movies. This is his thing.
Oh, boy.
So we've got one or two left. This is like farming robots with lasers. This is really cool stuff. They've got a farming robot now that kills the weeds with laser beams.
Ooh, this is cool.
It is very cool.
This is Star Wars, man.
This is R2-D2, like, yeah, the moisture vapor is the same thing. Yeah, it's cool stuff. And then the last one we have is the deep fake satellite imagery. So it's like I said, this whole theme has been AI deep fake shit. They're saying the geographers are going like, you know, guys, simply because you see a satellite image doesn't mean it's actually a real satellite image. So it's like, well, what the hell? What can you possibly believe in anymore? You might as well have like the police sketch artist show you the news every day. And Charlie Brown, yeah, it's like, yeah.
That nuclear silo is not actually there.
Yeah, and that's exactly the case they make. Is like one nation gets mad, another shows like the Cuban missiles crisis with the satellite photos, and the other, oh, look, they're fine.
Those troops are actually not on that border.
Yes.
No matter which way that picture goes, whether they're there or not, you know. No, there's no troops on the border. Look at our satellite.
This is really fascinating because there used to be, before we were born, that you would have a battle because a couple kings got mad at each other. Everybody got their swords out and he beat the hell out. Somebody won, somebody lost. But what's happened is become this sort of, battles have become this PR war where you have to sort of manage public perception. You produce fake images. You have fake news stories. And it's gotten to the point where we're constantly at war with this PR war, whether or not we're killing each other with swords or not. It's like, damn, it's a sucky time in some ways to be a human.
The technology is certainly different. I don't think the actual motivations are different. The disinformation in order to start a war, I think, has been going on for a very long time. It's just that we now have so many very good opportunities to do it.
Well, yeah, not only that, but we can create this illusion of depth of information
just out of
thin air.
It's much more reliable because this satellite's photo clearly shows that there are troops on the border right there.
I got on the internet in the 90s, and we would get into wonderful discussions and disagreements. I think it was, I used to go on the ABC News forum. And it would end with somebody going, oh, well, actually, go to Cornell. They did a study 15 years ago, and there's a PDF and all this. You could go find that PDF, and, oh, dang it, I guess I'm wrong. Those days are gone. No matter what position you have, I can give you 17 links that shows that, you know, those towers didn't burn down on their own, buddy. It was Elvis.
I wonder how this is going to work for sports. You know, the instant replay.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the refs have one version. Each team has their own version of what happened.
Each channel has their own, you know, CBS.
Oh, my God. You could actually take the video feed and slant it to, like, if you're showing the Dallas team in Dallas, God, those refs are awful. They kept making bad calls.
In real time.
Yeah. That's right. Each city would think the other city was cheating and getting away with a bunch of stuff.
Well, you can start wars that way. Oh, you guys, our team won.
I was listening to an audiobook about the history of the Roman Empire, which I kind of do those things, but what happened in Constantinople was the street gangs became their own political unit. So there's a red gang and a blue gang, and every now and then they just get swords and beat the hell out of one another.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does sound quite. They didn't wear the buffalo hat. I think that they missed
the buffalo.
It's So I don't want to get into that because I'm a law-abiding guy. If you broke the law, you should be punished to the full extent. I'll tell you the same thing I did with Valerie Plame. If you broke the law, punish him.
Absolutely.
But also, if you're wearing a buffalo hat in Congress, I don't know. You kind of reach moron status at some point. You're not going to hurt him worse than that. You're going to like pillory him. It's just, you know, he's going to be that guy for the rest of his life. Hey, it's buffalo hat guy. Bring him in.
Man,
crazy stuff.
Okay.
All right, so let's just do this. What do I got here? See, this is another duck. Let me wrap this up. I'll be right back, Bob. All right. Okay, so you've wasted yet another hour, a perfectly good hour. You could have been learning something useful. Instead, here you are, having fun with us. Hopefully, sharing some nerd news. We're here next week. We hope you have fun at work.